The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a quick look across some of today's front pages first. Listen, I'll tell you what, if you were a younger person in this country, you would think we just can't get a break, right? So the front page of the Sunday Times, HSE brace for more cases of monkeypox. But it turns out, right, that up to 1972, the state was vaccinating against smallpox. So all the boomers and most of Generation X need have no fear of our new monkey overlords. It's going to be anyone born after 1972. So that's the monkeypox, the Sunday Independent. Probably far more worrying thing, government on alert over growing risks to the economy. Mounting fears that stagnation in Europe will hit growth here. And they're mentioning this action plan to tackle inflation caused by Ukraine war, which is across a lot of the papers. The Business Post has their regular Red Sea poll. So there is a trend here and it keeps going and keeps going. Support for Sinn Féin in this poll now soaring to a record level in the latest Red Sea poll, 36%. So Sinn Féin now higher in that poll than Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael put together. And that's 1,002 people done online for that poll. The Mail, bookies fight ban on shops near schools. So gambling lobby resist key parts of new legislation. The Sunday World has a Kinahan story. They're having an investigation into there's a fear of a rat or a police informer in the organisation. And the Mirror also has a Kinahan story. Thomas Bomber Kavanagh desperate to be moved to an Irish jail. He's in Belmarsh prison at the moment, serving a 21-year sentence for smuggling 36 million euros worth of drugs. And The Sun has an interesting kind of upping of the ante of the passport story. According to this, passport office staff are being investigated for allegations for taking payments to fast-track passport applications. Workers in two offices are under suspension, accused of taking cash bungs. So people are actually possibly bribing people to get passports at this stage. So to go through the newspapers with us this morning, we're joined by Mark Little, co-founder of Kinzen, sociologist Niamh Horrigan from Mary Immaculate College, security analyst Declan Power, and politics reporter Gráinne Nye from PA, the Press Association. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Mark Little, can I ask you a question first in the generality of things off the front of that Sunday Independent there? I talk to business people who all seem to kind of be resigned to the fact that there's some kind of downturn coming now. A lot of them almost seem to kind of think, sure, look, it might clear out some of the froth and it might get people back to the office. And this, then you wonder, do these people remember what a downturn is like? But is that the general feeling in the business world at this stage?
You know, every element of the business world is kind of discrete in its own right. I'm in technology, so I see the big fear from a lot of technology companies that would be out there raising finance at ridiculous, extreme rates, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars they were taking on board. Now, suddenly, they're all just taking the cash they have and trying to bootstrap, as they say, in the business. So everybody knows something is happening, but they're not quite sure what it is. It doesn't feel like 2008 and 2009, but at the same time, it does feel like the major companies in the world that actually shape our futures, the Googles and the big technology companies, something's happening in there as well. So the idea, I think it's more like after the dot-com boom for us, where there was a temporary drop in people's confidence in what was going on in the world. And I think that's what it is. So in technology, certainly there's an uncertainty, but there's no certainty what this looks like. And it's in that middle point where we know something's going on. We're just not quite sure what this is.
We are seeing, aren't we, apart from the massive share prices of a lot of technology companies, we are seeing the beginnings of something we haven't seen in a long time in tech, which is a kind of a retrenching, job losses and cost-cutting and stuff
like
that?
But deeper than that, it's a feeling that this globalization dream that we've been living on for the last 20 years, and it's the basis of what the technology companies, is actually breaking down. If you can't get grain to people in the Western world, if the supply chains themselves are breaking down, if there's baby formula shortages in the United States right now, it fundamentally says that this globalized economy is in some ways breaking down. All of those things that keep us together, the supply chains, inflation coming back, we haven't seen since the 70s to extent. So there is a sense, I think, that that globalized promise that
do
all these big companies were driven by is
falling apart. Rather than breaking down, like Dan O'Brien is a really interesting piece today, looking at, and I suppose this is the thing, as Mark says, it's kind of amorphous. So there's been a debate going on in places like the Fed and the ECB for the last 6 months, which really goes back to almost whether it's going to be a hard or soft landing, which I know brings back nightmares for many Irish people, that particular debate. But essentially, that's what it is. And there seems to be a real lack of clarity about what's the cause. And that's what Dan O'Brien is getting at, you know, that some people are saying, well, it's quantitative easing and it's the way they did quantitative easing in the States. But a lot of other countries have done quantitative easing very successfully. Some are looking at China, because China now is coming to a definitive version of a halt some way or other in terms of this extreme global growth. Really, what it looks like to me is globalization is kind of reconfiguring. Like, one of the things we've seen in the last 15 to 20 years is the rise of these giants like India, Russia, China, etc., who were massive presences economically, but really had held back kind of politically. But now we're starting to see a follow through, which was always going to happen. And I mean, if we look at the war in Ukraine, and if that Russian-China political access continues to remain really meaningful politically, we are looking at a very different version of globalization for the next 50 years. And I see, this is where, as always, the political and economic are absolutely fundamentally intertwined.
And the ties that bind are unraveling, even in work. You know, we're just not quite sure if people are going to go back to work. We're looking, I was in New York recently and the subways at 8 a.m. were empty. I was getting from one side of the city to the other. So there's even a fundamental re-examining what work means.
I hadn't meant to get straight into the reconfiguration of the global future, but okay, we're down to it. Just to bring it back home slightly, you got to think this is very bad news for a small, very open globalized economy, heavily reliant on corporation tax receipts from big tech companies, etc.
Well, global tax reform has been pushed out, as Lucinda Creighton highlights today. So actually, in the immediate terms, perhaps not. Yeah.
Yeah, but we are heavily reliant on a lot of these big tech companies. If we start seeing job losses there, and they are the high earners in this economy. Grainne, to bring this back to a bit of bread and butter, that poll in the Business Post, the headline out of it, Sinn Féin on 36%. But really, I think what they're pushing is the underpinning to all that, and they're very interesting stuff on that, is basically that this is about three things: housing, housing and housing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, there's a couple of bits in the paper about what exactly the government's going to do about costing of living in general. But that poll does show that there is some sort of concern about how the government's handling housing, and that, you know, Richard Colwell is writing from Red Sea is writing that, you know, when the next election comes around, housing is most likely still going to be the main issue for people, which it was. Health and housing was the main issue for election 2020. But it also raises the point of, like, if the government is trying to handle housing, but some of the reports in the Mail, for example, is that they're kind of the centre of gravity of the budget is going to be about tackling childcare and third level education. So where does that leave housing if that's going to be the big selling point to consumers? I think that suggests it doesn't have a lot of confidence in its own housing policy, for example, if it's going to be selling childcare as a solution to people. And look what we're doing, particularly when a lot of people are saying childcare costs are like a second mortgage. They're not going to maybe handle the housing price issue, but they will handle childcare for people. So the poll about kind of lending rules in relation to housing is kind of interesting. We were chatting to a bit about it before going on air. Like, it does suggest that overall the picture is that the public do want more action on housing and on lending. And I think that is a fair kind of reading
reflect,
to make.
Would that reflect what you're seeing in your real life? Presumably your peers are about the age of house buying and trying to buy houses. Are they frustrated by the central bank rules, and do they feel they could sustain a greater mortgage than what they're being allowed to have?
I think... well, it's not, the central bank rules aren't a common topic of conversation among my friend group.
Okay.
But I would say that renting is, and renting costs. Like, one of the things that is a problem is saving is difficult when rents are so high. So it's difficult to do both. And home ownership is still really important for people. That is seen as the goal still to go to because tenancies are so fickle. So the problem is that it's hard to do both. And the poll in the Business Post today, you know, is suggesting that maybe deposits should be reduced for first-time buyers. Now, they're already at 10%, which is lower the first-time buyer kind of deposit for people. And 85% said in this poll that it should be reduced. But actually, that is just, I think, a symbol of how difficult it is for people to buy homes. It's not that the deposits are an issue or 10% is too high. It's more that the cost overall is still too high for people. Yeah. Okay. So maybe it's not, you know, the first time buyer's grant, that was very popular among my age group when coming up to the election. They liked that policy. But overall, and the ESRI and other organisations say it, it's not effectively economically the best way to bring down housing prices and to help people get on the housing ladder. So it's a complicated issue to kind of find out what's responsible economically, but also what works for people.
Yes. And so to find out that, if you put on your headphones there, we're going to talk to Professor Stephen Kinsler, who's Professor of Economics and Head of the Department of Economics in UL. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Brendan.
So look, you've had a look at this Red Sea poll is very interesting. And to what Grainne was saying there, you'd wonder, I think the argument is that we have policies that are to prevent a credit bubble, but that, as Grainne said, in a sense, I don't know, are we fighting the last battle here? The problem is a rent bubble. So, for example, 82% of people say that first-time buyers should be allowed to borrow more than 3.5 times their salary if they can show a history of higher rental payments. And I think a lot of people do feel, if I'm paying $2,000 a month rent and have been for years, why can't I get a $2,000 a month mortgage?
Well, I think one of the main reasons for not increasing either of those limits is because you'd end up with people being more indebted. And that's exactly what we had the last time. And you're right, while it might feel like you're fighting the last battle, what you're actually doing is preventing a buildup of unsustainable credit in the market. If you just think for a second about, let's say we increase it to five times your loan-to-income ratio and a 2% deposit, what you'll actually have is people going to the same market with the same amount of supply with a bigger checkbook. And the only thing that's going to happen, the house prices, is that they're going to rise. I was really surprised, by the way, that only 85% of people want house prices to fall. Like, who are these 15% of people that don't want house prices to fall?
And you see, we are told that there is an invisible, quiet kind of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael voters out there who quietly want the price of their houses to keep going up.
Enjoying the uplift, yeah. I mean, it is interesting though that home ownership is falling. So, you know, it was north of 75%, I believe, at one point. Now it's 67% and falling. So the constituency for people who want house prices to fall is rising. And I think that there's probably three things that need to happen. The obvious thing is build more houses, right? The second thing is, I think we are, the domestic buyer is in a competition with international investors. We need to make it more difficult for international investors to purchase properties with cash off the books, basically pricing anyone out of the market. So that would act immediately to reduce house prices. Just make the unfair competition a little bit fairer. Second and third thing, rather, is if we were able to introduce a vacant home tax, a vacant site tax that was also coupled with a rebuild grant that would stop some of the dereliction that we're seeing around. And we actually have quite high vacancy statistics here in Ireland, according to Eurostat. We're about in the middle. So if we could get rid of that, we'd be further along. There's, you know, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. Vacant property that are derelict. We could fix them up, and you know that would make things a lot easier for people.
It seems like such a no-brainer. Well, why isn't it happening?
It's very difficult to implement in practice. So if you rock up to a derelict house and you say, look, we need to fix this up, just finding the people who own it will be difficult. Those people will obviously be reticent to do it up for some particular reason. There's usually some family issue involved. And then when you say, okay, now you need to spend, you know, 120 or 130 grand to do up this thing, they'll say no. and we don't want to. And so that's where the tax, and there has to be both a carrot and a stick. Some people, I met somebody recently who said, look, I'd love to do up my derelict house, but I'm 65 and they won't give me a mortgage. So, you know, the mortgage rules bite again.
Yeah, now, and there does, in fairness, seem to be a bit more momentum around now the intention for a vacant property tax, and there is a push on getting homes back into use. The other thing that there does seem to be a certain momentum around, it's certainly becoming more and more part of the conversation, is something else here that the Business Post polled on is 76% of people, according to this poll, believe that small landlords should be given more favourable tax treatment on rental income properties in exchange for complying with a rent cap. Does that make economic sense?
It's not going to make a huge amount of difference, I don't think. You know, small landlords are regulating the market because they can't make a profit on their consumers.
Because they pay income tax, essentially, whereas the big investors are paying virtually no tax.
So exactly.
would it not mean, if we equalise that a bit more, would it not mean that you'd have less of that institutional investing and we wouldn't have that 25,000 of small landlords who've come out of the market in the last 5 years?
Well, if you think they're coming out of the market, but they're selling their homes, right? So they're giving their homes to somebody. Who's getting them? I think that's the point at which you want to intervene. People will make choices based on their own income and expenditure. You want to be able to have that go, you know, to a young couple that's able to afford it, or a single person that's able to afford it. As they go.
Okay.
But fundamentally, you're not changing the affordability.
And you're not changing the net amount of houses. It's just moving them around effectively.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Stephen Kinsella, from Professor Stephen Kinsella from UL. Thanks very much for that. So if we take the other strands of this, then Grainne was mentioning there, Niamh, the whole idea of inflationary measures or anti-inflation measures and all that.
Yeah, there's a theme running through the papers today, which is on the inflation cost of living piece. And it's interesting. There's first of all some consensus in the sense that what we've seen up to now is a kind of a catch-all throwing money at it approach. Both Ian Guider in the Business Post and Colin McCarthy in the Sindo highlight this. And that creates two problems. First of all, you rack up a lot of debt really quickly, which could potentially become unsustainable considering you already have a lot of debt. And the second thing, it doesn't actually target the supports to the group that need them most. And there's the narrative that's often put out by politicians is that, well, it's really expensive to figure out who are the group that's being. Actually, it's not, because we have a really good medical card scheme which does a really robust means testing and is actually an almost very close and very tight indication of who in Ireland, certainly of the population who we're here right now, actually needs the supports most. And one would be concerned that some of these catch-all measures really are more about political expediency, in a sense that there is also a squeeze middle as well as a deprive. But like, in fairness, if you are, you know, and we recognise that a lot of the you know, if you look in terms of the issues Grainne was highlighting in terms of third level education, childcare supports, those are aimed at the squeeze middle and they will be featured very prominently in the budget. But I mean, I work with a lot of organisations which are people are literally choosing between eating and electricity right now, today, and they are a group who need a very particular type of support and they need it really
quickly. So they need direct injection.
They need direct injection and they need direct supports around fuel, heating, electricity and food, just to survive. The other piece, and I suppose...
Do you think the whole focus on childcare and everything, what, you think it's a bit middle class like?
Well, it affects the middle class most, because those who are paying for childcare tend to be in that middle class group. They're also the group who are paying really high rents and are affected by, they're the target group at the heart of this particular poll. And that needs to be dealt with. I'm not for one minute saying that the childcare crisis doesn't, but there, to be perfectly honest, I personally feel that our response to the childcare crisis should be a structural response. We wouldn't dream of farming out our primary school children to the private sector and then subsidising them. And we do that in early childhood and we shouldn't be doing it. We should be paying them properly and it should be a properly, fully state-funded system. Anything else is just going to be a band-aid.
Okay, Declan.
As I'm listening to this, I'm struck by two things, some of which Niamh touched on and also which Stephen touched on, which seems to be we keep approaching these endemic problems with the same old formula and we need to shift culturally. And one of the things that seems to be an important cultural shift is addressing the issue of security and of tenure for people where they're going to live. So if younger people, I think, were able to be sure of living circumstances that they wouldn't be turfed out of, so they could live, plan, maybe even start families, and then work towards buying a house in middle age when they're more financially secure, that would be one kind of a significant step over a long term. The other thing that Stephen touched on was the vulture fund companies coming in, like, you know, addressing that issue so that ordinary householders or those who seek to be householders aren't competing with them. That seems like a no-brainer. And it all comes back to culture.
Is there not a contradiction in the two things you're saying there? Because these, like, vulture funds can be quite a loaded term, but these investment funds or whatever, are they not the ones we were always told would provide the kind of functioning rental market with long-term tenure and, you know, they'd be proper landlords, unlike, you know, the fellow who had a few kids from college staying in the house and then turfed them out when his own kid was going to college and all that.
The thing is, Brendan, they might be if we provided the proper legal framework for them to operate in. They're going to take whatever opportunities they get. I can understand that. But, you know, we don't have that kind of legal, at least to my knowledge, I'm prepared to be corrected, that it's a kind of an open plan. It's not like the continent where you can be in an apartment for 30 odd years and be sure that you'll be there. I'm not saying that that's entirely the answer, but I think it's a step. In other words, we need to do a bit of a cultural pivot.
Yeah.
And instead of just fixating on the same, build more houses, well, we're not. And there seems to be an enormous amount of different arguments as to why we can or can't. But in the meantime, we've got to do something that gives people security of tenure.
I think part of the problem with big firms coming in to the country, it was obviously to create that, as you say, Brendan, the variety in the market. So it wasn't all the supply was coming from one source, so that there was that security there. And that's fine. But the problem when big companies are competing with an average couple or individual to buy a home is where the problem is. And we saw that in the reporting, particularly from the Sunday Business Post over recent months, that was happening, and it really angered
people. Where they can effectively pay above the market value of it, because if they're viewing it as an investment tool, it gives it a different notional value for them.
They're more of a spending power. And then, you know, the rental market, you know, the Sunday Business Post poll saying that small landlords be given a favourable tax treatment if they comply with rent caps. It's basically rewarding them for doing something that the government says they should be doing anyway.
Yeah.
And that is the problem with the fickle or the volatility of the renting market, that you can't rely on even the rules in place to be implemented properly to protect tenants.
Looking at the political dimension, what I'm struck by is reading a lot of Irish coverage at the moment. We're missing kind of what is a political force in every country at the moment. Is generational inequality. And it's something you spoke to earlier on, like 15% of people want the house prices to rise, right? The rest of the people, this generation are coming of age in a time where they've got no expectation, as we did, of owning a home. They've got no expectation of a retirement, of a pension. They have conditions of employment today that are so radically different than what we would have enjoyed when we started out in the workforce. That generation inequality is at the heart of Sinn Féin's surge. That generation inequality is driving populism in the United States. And I think sometimes we focus so much on the question about the policy, and what we're not thinking about is what is the anxiety in the depth of your stomach. And I think for anyone who's under 35 in this country right now, it's got to be that sense we're not all in this together. And post-pandemic, that is such an explosive power in politics. I just don't think it's covered in that way in a lot of the coverage I see in a lot of Irish newspapers.
Yeah. I was listening to something recently, but they were pointing out that the liberal, kind of classic liberal political view was that people would vote for a party that would do something for them, right? But that there's an underlying thing to that, which is possibly more powerful, which is that people want to feel part of something, right? Are we dealing with a younger generation who do not feel part of the status quo as it exists, feel no stake in it, do not feel it's looking after them, and that parties like Sinn Féin and their equivalents around the world, people feel part of something there, part of something bigger, change?
I think it's less about being part of something and this sense of precariousness.
Yeah.
My whole existence in this society
poll
is conditional.
Is a lot more about what the government is not doing than what about Sinn Féin are doing. So Sinn Féin, given the extent of anxiety, and I suppose this is for somebody of my generation, like, health has always been in trouble. As long as I've been kind of sentient, there's always been issues with the healthcare system in Ireland. But I grew up in an Ireland where housing wasn't the way it is now, where there wasn't the level of homelessness, even in the deepest, darkest heart of the 80s, we did not have anything like the homelessness we have today when we are a much more affluent society.
Do you think the precarious, from which your sociological hat on, is the precariousness that Mark talks about with those under 35s, is that a new thing, or did every generation feel a little bit of precariousness when they were young?
And in fairness, that's happening across the world. So, you know, even if you look at the political environment that fed, you know, Trump and other things, we are looking now at generations where parents, you know, if you look at the post-war generations, statistically every generation got a bit more affluent and a bit more secure and a bit better off. Yeah. That's now flipped. And now generations are getting less affluent, less secure, and we're now facing into the potential horizon where you have people retiring with no pension and no home. And like, that's, given the numbers of people who could potentially retire, that's very, very worrying.
Declan, as a kind of a person who keeps an eye on the global picture, security, political shifts and all that kind of thing, is that precariousness, is that possibly one of the big forces that is kind of going to destabilise societies and the world over the next while?
I think it already is. And I think one of the problems, to just amplify something Niamh was saying there, is that this precariousness isn't fully understood by, we'll say, our generation upwards. So there's a dissonance between them in a way. I think every generation has had its problems, and we certainly, those of us who grew up in the 80s, can remember the precariousness, the nature of that. But there somehow was a notion, I think, that, you know, you had to go through the hard yards and you were going to get there. There was a sort of a game plan, and that's what's missing now at the minute. And I think the older generation that are in power, be it in politics, in economic terms, are struggling to find a way to communicate what the game plan is to the younger generation. And now, to come back to your point, on a broader canvas internationally, that in the Western world, that precariousness is being leveraged by, you know, those who have nefarious intent. And so you have totalitarian regimes, the Russians themselves, before they got embroiled in Ukraine, were busily putting their finger on that open sore through the mechanism of the online world and adding confusion and fire to the flames of ire in that generation. And that hasn't been helpful at all.
Can I go to the person who's closest to the precarious generation? Grainne, Ciara Phelan from the MIR was in here 2 weeks ago. And she is a person who she's a Polycar, so she's meeting politicians all the time. She's engaged with politics and everything. She was adamant to me, they do not get it. They are not hearing us. And I was saying, but they're doing X, Y, Z. And she said, look, I'm just telling you, I know they don't get it. Do you feel like that? A, do you feel the precariousness? And B, do you feel, as Declan was saying there, that politicians just don't get it?
I think the government, because I don't think you can say politics, I think the government believe their housing strategy will work. I don't think they realise that if they're wrong or if it's too slow, that a whole new generation of young people are going to emigrate for something better, whether that's better work conditions or better living conditions, or just to be able to buy a home when they want, at the age that they want to buy a home or when they're ready to. And that's what's at stake, really. You know, it's not a political or a theoretical debate that the government are saying you don't understand. This is like the future of the country and people's lives, and they will leave the country if it doesn't change fast enough. And they remember, this is the second housing strategy. There was one previously that Simon Coveney had launched, and they changed it, and Darrell Breen has launched this one, and we're waiting for this one to work, but the first one didn't. So, you know, how long do you wait for the government to deliver on housing before you say, OK, I can't wait any longer as an individual? And that is a problem.
And we should acknowledge that the government, as you say, they do believe they're doing everything they possibly can as quickly as they possibly can. And there are a lot of practical factors that can't magic up.
The Sinn Féin rise, I am glad that there is a party there that young people feel they can lend their support to in a democracy, because the flip side is they could totally disengage entirely. So it's a good thing in a way to see that surge behind a political party, because it suggests an optimism that things can get better.
Okay, listen, before we go to a break, Grainne, will you tell me about the political story that's on the front of the Sunday Times about Senator Mark Daly?
Yeah, so
I don't know why we're laughing. This is a perfectly plausible story.
So Mark Tighe has a story on the front page saying that fraudsters used a photo of Mark Daly, who's the leader of the Shannon and a Kerry senator, to scam women out of hundreds of thousands of euro on Tinder. And one New Zealand woman said, it was interviewed and said that she was infatuated by the online profile, which uses the photo of Mark Daly. But I can't remember Rodney Mullen was the name of the person and he described himself as the woman's Prince Charming. So it's using a photo. It's very, very random, but I suppose it's exploiting vulnerable people in order to get money out of them. And this particular woman involved sent 315,000 euro to the scammer. So it's small thing.
No, it's not a joke, but it does show you that clearly
people have to be careful.
Mark Daly is much more of a Prince Charming than any of us.
He's got pulling power in every sense of the word, it seems.
He absolutely does. Mark Little, you spent a lot of time in America, and you probably reported on school shootings, did you?
I was there for a few days after Columbine in 1999, spent an unforgettable 72 hours just watching this outpouring of grief in this tiny little car park and remembering the same again, you know, never again, never again. And then, of course, you know, 23 years later, I've seen my own kids when I lived in New York going through active shooter drills, walking past an armed guard outside the elementary school we went to. And so for me, there is that sense of, and I think Gaelic O'Hanlon captures it very well, you know, the deaf listening to the deaf. And that 23 years on, there is still access where a kid at 18 years old can buy an AR-15 rifle, 1,600 rounds of ammunition. Same kid couldn't get a beer. It'd be illegal for him to buy that. And so there's obviously quite clearly a broken legislative system. But there's a lot more going on beneath the surface here, which I think as Europeans and Irish people, and I think Eilish puts it really well, she said, because we're so close to America, we kind of understand America. But there's a sense now that, you know, that the cause of death among kids, biggest cause of death is gunshots. Mm-hmm. It's going, you know, beyond fatalities in the road. What you've got now, I think, is a sense when people see this is that they're not rushing to vote for politicians that will pass better laws. They're rushing to the gun shop because the more people feel unsafe, the more they see the mass shootings, they get the sense that there's people on the streets with guns. They arm themselves. And the statistics and some of the coverage this morning were quite striking for me is that the rate of gun ownership among African-Americans, among women, people who feel themselves to be besieged, is rising all the time. So passing laws is one part and an obvious part. And if you pass the law against assault weapons, you would reduce the level of mass shootings. But the rise in gun ownership reflects, I think, a sense for many people in America that if the legislator won't do it, we'll just do it ourselves and go buy guns ourselves. 400 million firearms in the United States.
Declan?
Yeah, I'm listening with interest there. And I think taking that a step further, I think the pivotal thing is in the long term in the US, it's a cultural issue. I mean, you have to address it from the perspective of how an organization like the National Rifle Association has such a pivotal, powerful place in US society. You need to counterbalance that going forward. Because, you know, it's an endemic thing. I was out for dinner last night with a cousin of mine who's American and a few of his mates. And he was a Marine and he served in Afghanistan. And he's appalled at gun culture in the US. You know, and so are his mates. Now, there's a significant chunk of people like that. But as they pointed out, there are huge swathes then of people who see they're reared in a way this is fundamental to their freedom. They're, you know, carrying a firearm is an existential thing for them, having the access to that. So it has to be addressed on that level. That has to be diffused. That has to be changed. And that will take time. In the meantime, unfortunately, we are stuck. I don't like the idea of it. I think it's ridiculous to talk about arming teachers. But I think in the immediate, you have to, in the States anyway, have to have the active shooter drills. You have to have a situation that those schools are properly secured. And when I say properly secured, like as far as I'm aware, there were security guards on that particular school. But you're talking about not just guys that are armed, but that are situationally aware. That
there's nothing to suggest that any of that makes any difference. And each one of the big Parkland, for example, there was someone who was defending the students, but they still went ahead. Every single one of these mass shootings, none of this matters. There's too many doors in schools, we've heard this week. It doesn't matter. Legislation would solve the mass shooting problem, but it's not just about this primeval frontier notion of freedom that they attach to guns. It's about something happening in American society as well.
Yeah.
And that sense that, you know, the only thing to stop a bad person with a gun is a good person with a gun. It's that bankruptcy of that thinking we've got to get over to get to real
change. The police who were armed didn't go in and confront the shooter until a good few minutes, and that response is being criticised. So when the police are afraid of confronting an 18-year-old shooter who was armed, how is arming, you know, on the other side going to help? Because,
well, I'm not saying that's the overall solution, but I do think you kind of have to, like, stop the blood flow, if you know, put the tourniquet on in a minute. And what you're talking about there is actually very relevant, in that the active shooter concept is something that has been developed since the advent of, you know, kind of the aspects of Islamic terrorism, where it was being franchised out and you could have somebody turn up and do a lot of damage because nobody was reacting appropriately. And there's a big problem with why that police department, they should have had, the Department of Homeland Security in the last 20 years have been overseeing a rise in standards and maybe too much of a rise in militarisation of the police. But one of the things was every little sheriff's department and police department were supposed to have a policy and an operational set of circumstances by recognizing this is a particular situation. Now, this is, we apply the active shooter concept, not standing off and letting what happened happen. So there, you know, there's a lot of questions to be asked at the operational level there as well, in terms of policing.
But on the sociological level, then. And I'm not going to kind of fall into the trap of saying mental health is an issue here, but how is an 18-year-old ending up
there's two things going on,
falling between the cracks, that lost?
Because there's actually, funny enough, relatively little research you'd expect from a sociological perspective. There'd be loads, but there isn't. There's loads of criminological research. So there seems to be two things going on. The first thing is really, and this comes down actually to the Second Amendment, it's the American conception of the state and how the individual sits within the state. So when I leave here this morning and I'm going off doing my Sunday, I'm not bringing a gun with me because I expect the state to guarantee my security. I expect the Gardaí to guarantee my security. So if somebody comes up to me and starts hitting me or I will call the guards. In the way the American state was conceived, and I suppose you can see, you know, the whole colonial experience, the kind of rejection of the state that was in the Pilgrim Fathers, that's really not there to the same extent. So the Second Amendment is almost saying, yes, we have this state, but you can guarantee your own security. It's an incomplete version.
Did I read that specifically, the Second Amendment, when you read it, it relates specifically to the need for a militia,
doesn't it? Yeah. So if we look at the research of how, so that's one thing that's going on. The second piece that seems to be going on, and it's very interesting actually, if you go back to the NRA, because if you look at the NRA, which was founded in the 30s, which we mostly focused on guns for recreation, so this was like hunting and all that, which is a very big part of American culture, and you see this really sharp flip in the 70s to a more extreme position. And one of the things that seemed to be happening there is that, and this is going to sound cliche to some people, but essentially middle class white males in the States who felt they were being emasculated turned very strongly to this idea of the citizen protector and the citizen soldier. So I am the kind of man who's going to protect my family. And this idea then kind of pushed the NRA very much to the right. This is also how this gun control issue becomes so closely linked to, for instance, Trump, who is again trying to harness all the same ideas. And indeed, the whole kind of Christian evangelical pro-life piece. That's how those pieces all link together. Yeah.
So it almost feels part of a broader pattern that we're seeing to some extent in this country as well, of something, Declan, that happened, people, over the last 2 years on the internet. A lot of people gone a bit lula, radicalised
and distrusting the establishment.
Everybody
authority.
Knows people like who were perfectly, you would say, normal people before, who now have all kinds of crazy ideas.
Yeah, you can't make an assumption that everybody will see, you know, the thing that, from the same perspective as yourself. I think it's kind of the atomisation of society. There was a time when we assumed we all saw the news at 9 o'clock last night and we take our
and
lead.
And we believed it.
And we believed it indeed. Yeah. But if we were going to debate, we were debating from a common platform. That's not the case anymore. You could be in company now where you can't assume that everybody will see the pandemic or the war in Ukraine from exactly the same perspective. But to go back to something, to what Niamh was saying there as well, and about how this is affecting young men, I think there's a lesson for us to take here in the West as well. Well, we don't have the same gun culture. We do have problems with the formation and, shall we say, mentorship and stewardship of young adolescent males. And, you know, because of what you alluded to there, Brendan, there's a lack of kind of focus. There's a lack of gravity, maybe, and their compass is spinning. And then they can get very, if they feel disenfranchised. There's a common theme you can see with a lot of these shootings. There's bullying maybe in the guy's life to begin with. There's a sense of dislocation, a lack of identity, a lack of maybe a positive male role model figure. And it all culminates in this tragic outcome.
I think we should separate the mass shooting from the gun violence, right? Because gun violence, I think, is a separate issue. The mass shooting, I think, is three things very clearly. It is, I think, to your point, it is about this idea of the suicidal intent, even when the person doesn't take their life. So these are suicidal, always, generally, young men who've been alienated from society. They may be just simply they were bullied, in the case of this particular shooter, at school. And what do they look for? They look online now. So their sense of radicalization is accelerated. And they see the copycat effect coming into effect. And what do they reach for? They reach for a semi-automatic weapon, which you wouldn't get in this country. Yeah. So you can't really separate it. They're a toxic brew.
Yeah, as Joe Biden said, there are lost people in every other country as well. Yeah. But this does not tend to happen. And the difference is that he was able to go in and buy that gun.
But this detachment, this alienation, atomization is quite a good word for it, where you just feel you're detached from society. Again, precariousness is partly to do with
this. Yeah, we're painting a very jolly picture of the world today. But I suppose, Niamh, part of our dystopian future as well is that there's now going to be facial recognition everywhere, according to some people. They'll be tracking us wherever we go.
If you weren't depressed enough eating your rashers this morning, you're now going to be facially recognised every time you go on the street. Yeah, John Mooney has a really good piece on this in the Sunday Times. I suppose from my own experience, I think it'd be well worth some of your listeners to look up some of the recent case law around the use of CCTV in Ireland, because there's been some very interesting cases recently involving public bodies and local councils, indeed, where they have received like six-figure fines from the Data Protection Commissioner, where the CCTV has been used where there was no legal basis, according to the Data Commissioner, and where cameras were used for other purposes than intended. And I suppose this is really where, given what we already know about facial recognition and how problematic it can be, and given that so far the use of technology by public bodies, surveillance technology by public bodies in Ireland, has been quite mixed. And it has to be said, I'm not completely opposed to, like, if we look at the Criminal Justice Act 2009, which Dermot Ahern brought in, there was tweaks to that act which allowed Gardaí to use surveillance, some of which, you know, phone surveillance, for instance, some of which was effective.
We're told it's in particular cases, like, I think there were quite emotive examples used, like a kidnapped child and that kind of thing.
You see, I, in fairness, given, and I think Drew Harris has made this point, given the type of technology it is and given its widespread use, I think if people were absolutely assured, and this is the case in some European countries, that it was being used correctly and only in particular cases, I think there would be a willingness to look at it. I think the problem is, going back to the CCTV example, is where technologies that are already there aren't being used like that. This is a much more deadlier weapon in that context.
Declan, is that it? That we don't? Sorry, Mark, I'll bring you in a second now. That we do not, do we trust the Gardaí to use this stuff the way it's meant to be used?
Well, this is the thing. I think Niamh put her finger on it there. I would have far more, to be honest, trust in the Gardaí with proper legislative application, using it in investigations. That's where I would like to see it. I'd be much more concerned about the lapses and abuses with local authorities and various other authorities, be they state or be they private, and their use of CCTV. I think there's a bit of a wide open space there that needs to be policed. But coming back to the issue of facial recognition being used as an investigative tool is something that's standard procedure in most other countries, and it saves a huge amount of manpower.
I'm looking at a piece by Roisin Costello yesterday in the Irish Times, and she's listing off the places that it's been rolled back right across America, which is a place we would think of as the kind of place that would do a lot of this kind of thing. Lists all those off, and also points out that in October 2021, the European Parliament adopted a resolution that called for a moratorium on the use of facial recognition and on the use of AI tools, given the varying degrees of reliability and accuracy. And under GDPR, as I understand it, biometric data, you're not allowed to use it anyway, are you? And this is
It comes back to how you use it and what you intend to do with it, and having a proper legislative framework for its use. Let's, if we could just draw an analogy, like the use of firearms in policing. You know, that it's not done in a haphazard fashion. There are very strict rules, procedures, and that there's oversight and a chain of command that oversees that. And that's the way I would like to see it be employed, because if it's employed properly, it's a huge manpower assistance tool. It speeds up investigations. And we shouldn't shy away from it because it has been abused.
Okay. We should use it. Mark, you wanted to come in now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a through line with this, with other areas where, you know, automated recommendations have given us all kinds of unintended consequences, whether it be going onto Facebook or insurance premiums. I mean, we've seen evidence that, you know, people who are subject to this actually can, there's a lot of racial bias can be built into these systems. Mm-hmm. So right across, there's a real movement now for more responsible use of artificial intelligence that says, first of all, there's always going to need to be a human review. There's a new approach to machine learning called human in the loop. It's very popular with medical diagnostics, where there always has to be a doctor catching the mistake, suggesting potentially a mistake that has been made. So I think, you know, for too long, we've regarded artificial intelligence as magic. And you can almost, if you insert the word magic when you see AI.
Yeah.
No, you generally see what's happening here. It's not. It's a human recipe. It's been created by humans, and it has impacts on humans.
And it has human biases.
Absolutely.
And human errors.
Okay. Listen, just, we were tracking the security times in Dublin Airport yesterday, and actually they've seemed fairly reasonable. This on Twitter in the last hour from Dublin Airport: due to significant queues inside the terminal for check-in, bag drop and security, passengers queuing outside the terminal may not make their flight, may need to contact their airline to rebook. We sincerely apologise for the obvious frustration and inconvenience this may cause. So we thought things were getting better there, but clearly not. Declan, we've spoken about this over the last 4 months, and we've had the same conversation every time, but the circumstances of that conversation change. So the off-ramp exit strategy, whatever you want to call it, in Ukraine is getting more and more complicated in a way, isn't it? Because there's people are starting to wonder now, well, does Ukraine want this war to end? Europe is kind of thinking, well, we need it to end. The Americans are feeding it. There's a lot of moving parts there, but none of them moving towards a resolution, are they?
Well, I think they're moving towards a resolution of sorts, and it mightn't be the one that people like to hear, but I think the Russians, by their own actions, are creating an off-ramp that is going to be hugely disadvantageous to them. And, you know, they're digging a pit, and the Western world is now helping them into it and as a way of containing them. It looks likely they will stay parked in the Donbass, whether they hold the whole lot of it or not. They're going to fight themselves to a standstill there. There's mass manoeuvre warfare on a level comparable to World War II going on there, and nobody is entirely sure what's going on because there's no direct media reportage of it because it's too bloody dangerous. And I think the Ukrainians,
the Russians winning in some shape or form at the moment.
Winning, it's a pyrrhic victory. I think there's a likelihood, if you can believe reports coming out at the moment, that they may take the Donbass, right? They may take that whole area. And then they're going to have to secure it. And there's going to be a continued low-level intensity conflict with the Ukrainians being able to keep nibbling at them with Western support. And the Russians will keep pouring in more resources, manpower, blood, treasure, and it'll keep bleeding them dry, and it will leave them in a much more powerless state. Now, it's a bit distasteful in one sense to look at it from that point of view, but it probably will be it'll probably be advantageous for the West, because it will not allow the Russians to project power in the way that they were doing. So when you hear people calling or saying things like, oh, we should stop arming Ukraine because it's just perpetuating the war, well, what they're really saying is we should reward the Russians, give them a win, and call that peace. Well, that won't be peace. That would be instability for Europe for a long time to come. Whereas this, it's a little bit like what's happened in Syria, without quite the Balkanization aspect. But the Russians have pushed themselves into this situation, and it'll probably reduce. There'll be less lives lost. The Ukrainians will not give in. And you will have this kind of, I would say, for a number of years, this ongoing conflict. And remember, the Russians are foreign here. They did it in the 80s in Afghanistan for nearly 10 years.
That kind of talk now will make people, say, on the left feel, so this is what America were up to all the time. It was about humiliating the Russians. And equally, Mark, Do we want a weakened, humiliated Russia, but with a load of nuclear weapons?
You know, at the beginning of this, I thought that famous old, it's a Republican line from Irish history about, you know, it's not the people who win are the people who not inflict the most harm, but those who can suffer the most. And I thought, well, the Ukrainians will definitely, given what they showed, the bravery they showed in those first days, be the ones will just wait it out. Putin's regime will collapse. Hasn't happened. And now we've got Russia inflicting, but suffering also pain. I mean, 15,000 people, or Russians died in Afghanistan, I think, Declan, if I'm right, over 10 years. Now, by the minimal estimates, that's the amount of Russian casualties in the first 100 days of this war. And yet, Putin survives. And I think that, for me, is one of the stories that I don't yet understand, is how has he managed to maintain such an iron grip? And also, you know, talk about, and there's, you know, reports yesterday in some of the Russian media that he's talking about going for Kiev again and declaring an absolute victory in September. It seems so detached from reality that I think Putin's longevity and his ability to keep inflicting massive pain, but also suffer it as well, is something that I think people may have misjudged. I don't know, Declan, you have a point of view on it, but there may be something going on that we don't see. It could be a very sudden pooch. But I think Putin's survival has been the story at this stage, I think, of the campaign.
I suppose, Niamh, though, are we... Sorry, Gordon, you wanted to come in
there?
I was
just saying, this war has been unpredictable from the start. You know, in the first week, people were saying Kiev would fall in the first week or two. And obviously that hasn't happened and the Russians retreated. It's almost impossible to predict because the Ukrainian... metal has actually been has surprised everyone, how long that stamina lasts, I suppose, is another unknown quantity. But it's been a disaster for Russia, because before there was a view of the Russian army that it was more powerful than it was, and now it's seen crumbling against a state that it thought would welcome it with open arms. I don't know to what extent that was true. So it can't, Russia and Putin can't retreat without some sort of win, and he won't. That's the problem.
Yeah. He can dress up the Donbass as a win, but coming back to what Mark said, there's two things. The Russians, if you look at their history, militarily and politically, they have a capacity to absorb huge amounts of attrition, huge amounts of pain. It's one of their military strengths, in a way. They're not agile, they're not mobile, they have a very autocratic regime. Their junior officers and NCOs are not autonomous, and that makes them very immobile on the battlefield, but they can just take the pain. And I think I don't see Putin being booted out anytime soon. But if this drags on, not the war itself, but the loss of Russian prestige and ability to project power will eventually lead to him being removed in some shape or form. But you could be looking at a few years, because it's a totalitarian regime.
Yeah, like Niamh, that's it. We're applying our own kind of standards to what might happen in Russia, isn't it? Or they'll be out in the streets and they'll get rid of Putin, because
the core issue is that, and I think this is where a lot of the talk around sanctions early on, you know, a lot of the thinking theoretically around sanctions is that you foster internal dissent. And Guy Verhofstadt has made this point repeatedly. Internal dissent is not allowed in Russia.
It's not allowed.
So therefore, the bandwidth, and unfortunately, they have a history of, you know, toxic autocratic leaders who, like, this is the second time in 100 years, effectively, that this type of leader has emerged and gone on this kind of crazy jag, basically. And they internally, and like that, they didn't take Stalin down either, really. And that, I think, is where the West needs to flip its thinking a little bit in the long term. One of the papers says today, you know, the Ukrainians are the world experts at fighting the Russians. That perhaps is the thing that's really going to make the difference in the long term here.
Okay, guys, thanks very much. Mark Little, CEO and co-founder of Kinzen. Declan Power, defence analyst and writer. Niamh Horrigan, sociologist at Mary Immaculate College, and Gráinne Nié, Press Association.